Veterans Voice, May 20th, 2011, KBOO Portland. Host Marvin Simmons of Northwest Vets for Peace interviews Bob Chenoweth, who was a prisoner of war in Hanoi for 5 years and a member of the Peace Committee while in prison. Members of the Peace Committee were deeply affected by their combat experiences and as a result re-examined their basic assumptions about war. They made radio and print statements against the war while in prison. In the second part of a two-part interview, Chenoweth discusses some of his experiences in prison.
When you were talking about the raid on Sante Prison and that there was nobody there, that they'd moved, did they move those guys from that prison to the one you were in?
No, I don't know where they moved them. Probably they moved them into Hanoi. But I know they had been moved out like 4 or 5 months before the raid.
And yeah. do you know what the name of that prison was that you were in?
I don't.
No,
we just called it Hate. We knew we were in Hate province, but I don't know what the particular area was called.
I know when you were in the south, in the prison in the south, that you were all mixed together, right? Was the officers enlisted all together? Are they separated?
No, not in this camp. The warrant officers sometimes were with the enlisted men, but for the most part, the officers were separate.
You were captured in February of 68.
Right.
When did you go north? What year did you go north?
Well, it was in 68, but It was about April.
Okay.
So we stayed a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more than a couple of months in the south and in probably in Laos. We were probably along the border somewhere between Laos and Vietnam.
And then they walked you over to...
we walked up to the trail and then we rode trucks.
To Vinh, right?
I don't know that we were ever in around Vinh because... It's close. It was close to the coast, I think.
Right. Yeah, Vinh's close to the coast.
Yeah. No, we stayed in the mountains.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. We stayed in the mountains until we got above the 20th parallel. Then we got out on the plains again.
Okay. Was when you were in those, how many people were in each room?
In the camp that we were in the south, we stayed in a camp for 1 month after we were captured, and it was just us.
Okay.
And Rayford. And then when we moved north, we moved with some South Vietnamese and some Americans that were captured at Hue.
Right.
And I think altogether there were probably 15 or 16 of us. But when we got to the camp, the first camp, which was the camp people called Porthole.
Porthole.
And that was in Nghi An. That camp... there were already five guys there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came, I know Rayford went into room 6. We stayed in a building that was raised up off the ground a little bit and had individual rooms.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And then it had thatch roof. And the rooms were just, they weren't quite tall enough to stand completely upright, but almost. And then they were about maybe 4 feet wide and about 7 feet long.
Pretty small.
And they had stocks in the ends of the rooms.
So were you put in stocks at night?
No. Only if...
you did something bad.
If you did something, yeah. So, but I don't remember anybody ever being in stocks.
Okay.
But they were an obstruction because it limited the amount of... room you had to stretch out.
Right.
And that was the one where in the back of the room there was a round hole.
Yeah, that's where that porthole came from.
Yeah,
I'm going to read the names of these guys and when they were captured and what branch they were in, okay?
Okay.
Okay, Alfonso Riotti, he was captured on April 26th, 1967. He was a Marine. King David Rayford, he was captured July 2nd, 1967. He was Army. He was African-American. And Riotti, he was Filipino, right?
He was Filipino and Karuk Indian.
Okay. And then
California.
Yeah. James A. Daly Jr. was captured January 9th, 1968. He was in the Army. He was African-American.
Right.
Okay. And then John A. Young was captured January 31st, 1968, Army. And then Robert P. Chenoweth, you were captured February 8th, 68. You were Army. Abel Cavanaugh, he was captured April 24th, 1968. He was a Marine. I didn't know that. And then Michael P. Branch, May 6th, 1968. He was Army. And then Frederick Elbert Jr., he was captured August 16th, 1968. He was a Marine. And so Alfonso was a Philippine Native American. King Rayford was African American. James Daly was African American. And the rest, everybody else was white?
Yeah.
White guys? How did you guys get together and decide that you wanted to talk about that you were against the war? How'd that start?
Wow. Man, that's a good question. Well, when we were in that camp called Portholes, I know there were a bunch of us together. We were in this camp that had individual rooms. It was a hamlet that was the village we were in had three separate hamlets.
Mm-hmm.
One had Arvins in it, and then the other two had Americans. And the area we were in was all enlisted guys, and then there was another hamlet that had civilians and officers. And gosh, it must have been around July or August of 68 that they moved us into what they called a communal building. It was a building that had raised up mats on each side of the room,
mm-hmm.
of the long walls, and we were all together. And it wasn't the same group. Mike and I were there, and there was a guy named Ron Ridgway, who was a Marine. John Deering was there. He was captured at Way. And Rayford,
mm-hmm.
and Dick Burgess. I don't remember all who else. I think there were about 10 of us there. And that's actually where we started doing stuff.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We talked, and we decided we wanted to do stuff. John Deering played the guitar. And so the Vietnamese eventually brought us a guitar, and we made up some songs. And they recorded a few of those songs that we did. But they were, you know, they were mostly songs. They were pop songs where we had the tune and John could play the chords and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made up anti-war words.
Wow.
To the song.
And that was early. Bob, did you have kind of the anti-war feelings before,
you know,
during
I
your first
just,
year over?
I have to honestly say no,
okay.
that I didn't. Not in the sense that I had any kind of political consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I hadn't figured out what was going on, but I'd seen enough and done enough to where I had questions about what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And after talking with the Vietnamese, after we got captured and learning a little bit about their history and who they were and everything, a lot of the things that I had seen myself, I just began to rethink those things and kind of tried to put them in a different perspective, because some of the stuff just didn't make sense to me.
Right.
You know, we were told that when we went over there that we were helping the Vietnamese and that we were liberators and all that. Americans, for the most part, were very contemptuous towards the Vietnamese.
Right.
Looked down on them, mm-hmm. and, you know, we didn't trust them. So, but I, you know, I saw the protests, because we would go back and forth between Tansanut and the hotel we lived in Saigon, and we would go by the presidential palace. And I remember during the elections in 67, you know, they would, there were Buddhist monks and other people that were protesting in front of the palace and doing hunger strikes and stuff like that. And, you know, I had some Vietnamese friends, and they told me stuff like, you had to vote for Nguyen Cap Ky. And I said, what do you mean you had to vote for him? Well, they said the army would come, and they would take you to the polling place and ask you if you voted for, mm-hmm. for President Ky. You know, you had to.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you didn't get your identity card back. They would take your identity card.
You'd be in jail. You'd be in prison.
Yeah, so it was just a lot of stuff like that. But I think I just, you know, I just stashed it away. I didn't think about it. I didn't have anything to bounce it off of. So I just had what I had learned growing up.
Right.
You know, that we did good. You know, we fought in World War II, and we fought in World War I, and we fought in Korea. And those were all good. It was all good we did that. And here we were in Vietnam.
Not doing good. Of the guys that eventually were the peace committee, who do you think out of those guys that I just mentioned were the most radical of anti-war?
Well, I think everybody was in their own way.
Okay.
I think everybody approached it from a different perspective, from different experience. John Young, definitely. Al Riotti.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, to some degree. Jim Daly, but from a perspective of being nonviolent, being a pacifist.
Yeah, he was a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah, he was a Jehovah's Witness, and he just went, you know, he didn't want to go in the army.
No.
But he wasn't whatever they call it. He wasn't like a card-carrying member of the Jehovah's Witness
right,
at the
that,
time.
Yeah, that was his problem.
And they just gave him one runaround after another, and they told him, you know, when he was in basic training, he applied for conscientious objector status. They told him, you know, wait until you get to your unit, and then you can apply there. And they just kept doing that, and then eventually he was in Vietnam, and they told him, you know, you better carry the rifle. And he told him he wouldn't shoot. He wouldn't shoot it.
Because he wrote that book. His is the first book that
right.
that I read. And he wrote that like pretty early, 75 or 74.
Right, yeah. He wrote it with a guy. I mean, he had a professional writer that
right.
actually did the writing.
Yeah, and he...
But it was his story.
It's really... I have a copy of it. And
yeah.
He came right... I mean, he just talks about he not wanting to be in that war. Not he wasn't going to shoot
yeah.
anybody. He wasn't going to
yeah.
kill anybody, and he meant it.
But
Go
you
ahead.
Know that was his religious belief was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what guided him. That's what guided him. So at times, you know, when we would talk about things, at times there were things he didn't go along with, and times other things he did go along with. So. You know, like when we wrote letters and things like that, we didn't just write something and everybody said, yeah. I mean, we agonized over it. You know,
you're talking about
we would discuss the wording for days.
Okay, you're talking about the letters that were sent or the letters
right.
that was read over the Hanoi radio and those
yeah.
that you guys would talk about those before you would do them.
Exactly.
When you first guys all got together down south... You didn't start really doing stuff against the war until you had moved to the north, right?
We didn't even really start actively until, I would say, until we got to Hanoi. I think people did things on their own. I know I wrote a little bit, and I did a lot of artwork and stuff like that.
You wrote a poem.
Yeah, I wrote poems and lots of different stuff. So, but I think the Vietnamese were more interested at that time in really kind of gauging our feelings, you know, assessing what our feelings were and what we knew. So, you know, they were careful. They
sure.
didn't want a situation where we said stuff that we didn't mean.
Right.
Or we said stuff, and then when we went home, we would say that we were forced to do that.
Right.
So they were very conscious of that. Well, it was a slow process. It was a slow process to get them to the point where we could kind of take the initiative ourselves. So,
when you were up north, you finally got up north. Were all of you together? The guys, the names I just read. Were you guys all together at that prison just south of Sante?
No. We didn't all get together in the same room until probably late 1971 in Hanoi. We were living in the plantation.
Yeah, the plantation gardens, they called it.
Yeah.
And that's when...
But we had been in the north for almost 3 years by
right.
that time.
Had you individually... While you were in the north, before y'all went to the plantation gardens, the prison, were you guys writing anti-war letters? Were you doing the radio talks on?
People were doing things individually, I think, but I don't know to what degree.
Were you doing it?
Yeah.
How did that work?
One of the things that finally happened was that they moved us all in together. But that was a long process. Like, I had never lived with Mike Branch or John Young or John Sparks. John Sparks was another guy that came into that room with us.
Did he stay part of the peace committee, or did he leave finally?
No, not really. I think he was nervous. Mm-hmm. There were people that were, you know, everybody was worried about what would happen to us when we got back. So. I mean, we were conscious of the fact that, you know, we were going against the flow, as it were. So, but we felt like it was the right thing to do.
Well, it was, Bob. It was the right thing because...
And if we had the... We felt like if we could add a voice from our perspective, you know, then it might help people.
Might end the war faster.
Yeah.
When you finally moved you into Hanoi, to the plantation garden, which is probably... Only, Bob, about 7 or 8 blocks from the what they called the Hanoi Hilton. It wasn't
right.
that far. You guys weren't that far away. So when you finally got there, is that when there were more radio broadcasts and more letters written?
Maybe. I'm not exactly sure in terms of the volume. But I know we did do some letters and stuff with other people besides the people that were in our room, Floyd Kushner and Francis Anton and some of those guys that also were writing letters.
Yes, some of those guys were officers.
Yes.
Because I think Anton, he was an officer.
He was a warrant officer.
Yeah, warrant officer. He was a pilot, helicopter pilot. Right.
And Kushner was a doctor.
And so those guys were writing stuff, and were they talking on the radio also?
Yeah, and then we did some joint things together. We did some stuff where we would sit down and write what we wanted to say together. But it was that same process. You know,
it was that thinking, yeah, the process where you all got together and you decided what you wanted to do.
You know, oh, we don't want to say this, or, you know, this might sound a little too harsh or unbelievable or
right.
something like that.
Did you do those right in the camp, or did they take mm-hmm. you to a radio station?
No, we did it right in the camp, and we recorded for the radio programs right in the camp, too.
Right in the camp. Those went on, I know they went on the international.
Uh-huh.
You know, they went around the world. When you were actually sitting there talking into the microphones, did they ever look at you and say, don't say this or don't say that?
No. We had everything written. Like when we were talking, it would all be written out.
Yeah.
And if we had a lot of times, well, just to give you an example, we would want to use expressions that were, you know, vernacular expressions
right.
that were common to soldiers or common to Americans, and they would resist that. No, that's not good grammar or something. And we would say, well, that's the way we say it. You know?
Yeah.
And so we would have those little kind of things with them where they would want us, and we would tell them, you know, if we say it this way, it's going to sound artificial. It's not going to sound natural. It's not going to reflect the way we talk, so, the way we use the language. So, you know, we had to wrangle with them to get our way, and we didn't always get our way.
Right. So Anton and Kushner, those guys had been down in the South a long time, and Daley, before they got moved up, they were down there a long time.
Yep. They came up, I think, in 1970 or...
Wow, they were down there 2 years.
Maybe it was in the summer of 71.
Wow, 3 years.
They came when we were in the plantation.
Oh, so you'd already been moved to plantation.
No, they came after we got there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they weren't in the plantation when we got there. They didn't move with us from Hatte. Well, I think they took the train. I know they said they took the train.
Boy, I mean, there's such a difference in those guys than, say, the pilots that were there. I mean, physically, their whole bodies were completely different because they lived in the jungles. They didn't have a lot of food to eat, and the medicine was really horrible.
Yeah.
You know, these guys really had it rough.
And they did have it rough. I think among all the people that were captured, the pilots that were shot down in the north had it the best.
Oh, there's no doubt, Bob.
Yeah.
There's no doubt.
I mean, those guys were getting packages from home, and, you know, they were getting all kinds of stuff. And I remember when we moved into a room that they vacated in the Hanoi Hilton when we first moved. It was on the 27th of December, 72. And we moved into this big room that the pilots had left out of. I mean, the stuff they left behind is stuff we would have killed for.
Right.
Yeah, it was amazing.
How did they get the name? Who came up with the name the Peace Committee?
You know, I think when we were just, when we were in the plantation, we were doing a magazine.
When did I ask you about
that?
We
would put together a magazine. You know, I think just in the course of talking about it, and, you know, we were drawing up logos and different kinds of stuff. What should we call ourselves? Should we call ourselves anything? You know, I think it was kind of a group discussion.
Because you and I had talked about that magazine before, and I remember the last time I was in Hanoi, I went to the archives, and I really looked for that. I'm sure somewhere in the north, got a copy of it.
We did, probably 7 or 8 of them. You know, they were like 35, 40 pages. It was all hand-done, and I did all the artwork for it, and Al did most of the writing. He had really good penmanship. Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly anti-war poems and anti-war stories?
Yeah, well, it was everything. We wrote articles. We had a comic strip. I did a comic strip.
Wow.
It was a black guy and a white guy in the Army.
Uh-huh.
In Vietnam, it was called Skate and Soul.
Good for you, Bob.
Skate was the white guy. And Soul was the brother. And they, you know, they just talk little stuff about the war and about what they weren't going to do this and they weren't going to do that. And, you know, but it was, we just tried to have a lot of variety in there.
Well, you had to have something because you were there for 5 years. My gosh. You know, a lot of Americans, you know, when I was there in 68 and I didn't know anything about the Peace Committee. I didn't know, you know, I never heard any of that.
Well, I think most people don't know, for example, that people were released.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were, I think, a couple of dozen POWs that were released during the war.
Yeah. Well, one
most
of them...
Most people don't have any idea about that.
Yeah. And one of them was a guy you know was George Smith.
Yeah, George Smith was...
George, he was captured in, like, 64. I think he was captured in 64 down south. Was it? Yeah, it was early.
Released in 64.
Yeah, he was released. That's right. He was released in 64. He was captured in 62.
Well, there was another guy. There was that one guy, Isaac Camacho, escaped.
Wow.
Because they were all captured together. They were a part of the special forces. And then George and another guy were released from the South.
Right.
And, you know, that guy, Bob Garwood.
Why do you know, Garwood's an interesting case, Bob. That's an interesting case. Did you ever, if people don't know who Bobby Garwood was, a Marine, and he was captured in 67 or somewhere around there, and he didn't leave Vietnam until the mid-70s, right? 79,
he didn't
maybe?
Leave until 80, I think it was 85 or 86 when he finally came.
Oh, really? So he was,
yeah.
And you know, there was so many stories about they kept him, you know, they just kept him there and he didn't want to come home, and that never really got shaken out.
He was in the same camp with Daley and all them, with Daley and
Down Christian, south, right.
Anton, yeah. He and two other guys were released. And
the Viet Cong released them?
Yeah, and Garwood said, I'm not going back.
He just stayed there.
I want to stay and help.
Wow.
So, you know, the way those guys told it, the way Daley and them told it, he joined up. You know, he joined the VC.
He just stayed with them.
Yeah, he was a guard, and he did propaganda stuff and stuff like that. I don't know if he fought or not. And I, you know, I don't know how much of it is true, but that's everybody that I talked to told the same story. So I believe them.
Yeah.
I believe what they say.
Right.
And then at some point, Garwood came up north.
Mm-hmm.
And what I heard was that he got married and, you know, he had a family outside of Hanoi. And then at some point, he got in touch with a correspondent or something in Hanoi and gave him a note that he wanted to go back. And he eventually came back, and then they put him on trial.
But he just stayed. He stayed.
Yeah, he stayed.
Did the Peace Committee ever get threatened? You don't have to say anything, Bob.
Directly threatened, mm-hmm. I would say sort of.
Okay, that's all you need to say.
Yeah.
That's all you need to say.
Yeah, did but only by a couple people.
Right. By who?
A couple of officers.
Okay, yeah. Oh, tell, you know, the when you and I talked, you told me about the time that you had to go to the dentist.
Yeah.
And that was this towards the end of the time?
Wisdom teeth. It was in it was before April of 72. It was cold. It was probably in January or February of 72,
mm-hmm.
because they took me to Bac Mai Hospital.
Bac Mai.
To the dental ward, because I had impacted wisdom teeth, and they were starting to erupt, and they were, it was very painful. So I went one time, and they looked. They just did an exam. And then the next time I went, the dentist that I saw, it was a woman, and she took x-rays. But they didn't have the kind of things that we have for x-rays with these little pads. They
yeah,
call
they
bite wings.
Bite wings, right.
And so what they had to do was take film and then wrap it up in black paper and stick it in your mouth and try to get pictures. And she was able to get a couple, but it was my tooth on the lower right side that was the one that was hurting. But she got x-rays of the top ones and then the one on the left, lower left. And she said, well, since I have a good picture of that one, let's go ahead and get that one right now, and then the next time you come back, we'll get the other one. Well,
never went back.
No, I didn't go back after that one. But the tooth, I mean, I didn't care what was going on with that other one after I had that one pulled, because it knocked me out for a couple of days. I had it taken out with only, they didn't have hardly any Novocaine or anything like that.
So they yanked
it. I got
it
a little bit when they cut open my gum, but then that was it.
They just yanked it right out.
She used a drill and drilled it in half.
Really?
They pulled each half out.
My.
Yeah, they were big.
Wow.
And that wiped me out.
Oh, that had to do.
That just, I slept for like 2.5 days when
wow.
I got back to my room.
I was going to ask you also about, you and I had talked before about this, when the Christmas bombings of 72, in fact, they bombed that hospital, didn't they, Bob?
Yeah, well, they bombed it in April, I think.
In April.
Yeah, they bombed it, I think, in April of 72.
Yeah,
the dental clinic was ruined.
Was just, yeah, because yeah. I know that they just, when they were bombing neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Neighborhoods.
Yeah.
They were just bombing neighborhoods in, you know, these weren't military targets. These were not military targets that they were bombing. And you were telling me that the guards came in and gave you shovels and told you to dig a hole.
Yeah, yeah, right through. We got a pick and shovels, and we had to dig right through the concrete floor in our room. And it was only a couple inches of concrete, but we got through that and started digging a shelter. It was a lot of work, but we were digging.
Oh yeah.
Because it was going off, you know, bombs were going off all around. So, yeah.
I thought it was kind of interesting that you found old French. What was it you found?
The camp had been a battalion. The French had these, what they called flying battalions, I guess, something like that. They were mobile. They were mechanized battalions. And they were in these cantonments, these walled encampments, all around Hanoi and outside and everything, but they were self-contained places, and that's what the plantation was. It was one of those camps,
mm-hmm.
And the rooms that we were in along the north side of the camp,
okay, it
was the motor pool. They were bays in the motor pool. So when we started digging, that's the kind of stuff we started finding at first, old air filters and oil filters and spark plugs and tools and stuff like that. And then the deeper we got, we started finding old, you know, ancient coins, and it was like an archaeology project in our room.
Did you keep any of it?
We told the guards. We told the guards, you know, we showed the stuff to the guards, and the guard said, well, we'll contact the museum. And a couple of days later, this guy came down from the museum, and he looked at all these coins and stuff, and he said, oh, he says, this is all over Hanoi.
So it wasn't anything big.
He said, it's too common.
It's too common. Uh-huh.
He says, because, you know, Hanoi is over 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
He said, everywhere, he told us, everywhere you stick a shovel, you find this kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Hanoi. So,
how did they feed you?
How did they feed us?
Mm-hmm.
Well, generally, what happened, the food would be parceled out at a central location. Like when it was our room would get water in the morning. We would get a bucket of water in the morning. It was tea, and then we would get whatever we were having for breakfast. If it was, let's say, some rice or bread or something like that, then they brought it in a basket. And then a couple of people would come to the door, and then we would get it, and then we would hand it out to everybody.
Okay.
So if we had a pot of soup, then everybody got a bowl, and we divided it out. You took turns dividing out the food. You know, one person did it for a day and another person. But it was usually two people together. So you poured it all out, or you spooned it out, whatever, so that it was even.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people that were doing it, the people that were dividing it out, were the last two to take it.
Well, you wanted to be pretty sure everybody got a fair share
yeah,
if you were the last
exactly.
guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you get bread? Was there bread? Or?
Yeah, we would go back and forth. We would have bread for 3 or 4 months, and then we would have rice. And then we would have bread, and then we would have rice.
Did you have? Did they give you? How, did you have drinking water?
Yeah, but it was tea.
Tea, okay.
Yeah, the water was always what we called tea water, mm-hmm. but it was always tea. And they didn't want you to drink it when it was cold.
Oh, really?
Well, the Vietnamese, even when you're in the jungle, you know, if we'd get a canteen of water, we'd stick it in a stream or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and then we wouldn't drink it for a while, and we'd carry it until it cooled off.
Oh, I see.
And then they would want to take it away from us.
Because it was cold.
Drink it. Yeah, they said, no, it's bad for your stomach when you're walking, you know, to drink cold water.
Mm-hmm. How about in the camps, were there showers? Did you shower? Did you have shaving equipment?
We never had showers. We always had a water source of mm-hmm. some kind, either cisterns full of water or wells. And in Hanoi, we had a room that had a cistern in it,
mm-hmm.
and we dipped the water out of there to wash our clothes. You had buckets, and you take the water out to wash your clothes,
mm-hmm.
and then you take the water out to wash yourselves.
So, okay.
And when we lived in the countryside, you had, it was always wells. So you pulled the bucket up. You had a bucket or two
mm-hmm.
On a rope. And you drop it down in and pull the water up. And, you know, you wash your clothes first, and then you wash yourself.
Right. So go ahead.
A couple of buckets of water you pour over yourself and then soap yourself down and wash up. And then a couple, three more buckets to rinse yourself off.
Yeah. It seems like every day was basically the same, and day after day after day after day.
Well, it was, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, most every day was the same. But then there were days where something would happen or there'd be something different or whatever. And then periodically they would shuffle everybody around.
Yeah, they would move different guys into different rooms and separate you guys.
Yep.
Did they do that much in the plantation garden?
A little bit.
A little bit.
It was less frequent.
Okay.
But they did do it.
So did you ever... When your room would go out, because I've been there, and so when you would go out to that little area, you know, that clearing area,
right?
Would there be anybody from any other rooms, or if it was just your room, you're out, and then you went back in, and then another room came out?
No, there would be other rooms that would be out too, mm-hmm. but you were pretty much separated from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, when you actually found out. That the war was going to end and you were going to be released. How did they tell you?
They came into our room. The camp commander came into our room with the interpreter. And the interpreter told us that the peace agreements, that they had signed peace agreements in Paris. And there was a part of the agreement that talked about the exchange of prisoners, and they said, now we're going to read it to you. And then they read it to us.
They read it.
And it was a couple of pages that explained the timeline, you know, what things were supposed to happen on what days and all that kind of stuff. You know, we didn't know exactly the day we would be released, but we knew that we would be released within 90 days. That was what the document said.
You'd be released within...
All prisoners would be exchanged within 90 days of the signing of the document.
When it was finally your turn to come home, I mean, finally your turn to get on the plane, to come back, were all the Peace Committee guys together on that plane?
Yes,
we did
all come out on the same plane.
Mm-hmm. So what day did you come out?
It was the 15th of March, mm-hmm. Hanoi time,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam time.
Right.
But it was the 16th in the
Over
US.
Here, right.
Yeah.
And so they took you to the Xilam.
Yeah, the Xilam airport. We got on buses.
Mm-hmm.
Our group, there were about 30 of us, I think, and our group got on two buses.
Right.
And then we drove out of Hanoi, north of Hanoi,
right,
across the river.
Across the bridge.
Yeah, and then drove a little ways and then stopped just on the edge of the airport. And we had been given civilian clothes. We had been given shoes and socks, and we had blue pants and gray jackets that zipped up the front.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had little tote bags, leather, black leather tote bags.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our stuff in there.
You brought back a tea set, right?
I brought back a tea set, a set of my prisoner clothes, rubber
really?
Shoes. Yeah.
When you got...
A rice bowl, chopsticks, my everyday chopsticks and my holiday chopsticks.
So when they let you, they let you off the... You got off the bus.
Yeah, and then we got into two lines. We got into two lines.
Okay.
And then on the airport tarmac out in front of one of the hangars, they had a canopy set up, and they had all of the ICCS people
right.
were on one table in a long line, and then there was an American group. And then there was an Air Force officer that greeted us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we stood there in line, and they called our names one at a time. And you stepped forward, and there was a Vietnamese guy there that you shook hands with him, and then you shook hands with the Air Force guy. And then two people were waiting in flight. You know, they had on coveralls.
Right, flight.
And they would... escort you. They took your bag and they escorted you out to the plane.
And you got on the plane.
C-141 that was sitting out there.
Yes, I heard that they were supposed to there was supposed to be somebody that knew you was supposed to be your escort.
Yeah.
Was that true? Did you know the guy that was your escort?
I did not.
Okay.
But he was somebody that had been in the same unit that the colonel. We had an Army colonel that was in our helicopter.
Yeah, Purcell.
Shot down.
Yeah.
Ben Purcell.
Yeah.
And this guy knew Purcell.
Okay.
I didn't know who this guy was. But what I did learn fairly quickly was all of these guys were from Army intelligence.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah,
I was going to ask
all
you about
came,
that.
They all came from an intelligence unit that was... based in Okinawa.
Okay, then once the plane took off and you got out of Vietnamese territory and you were heading for the Philippines,
yeah,
that had to be a good feeling.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it was, I had pretty mixed feelings. I mean, I wasn't jumping up and down like
right.
crazy then. It was... you know,
okay.
It was measured.
Okay.
if you
yeah.
know what I mean.
Oh, I know what you mean.
I mean, the ride through Hanoi to the airport was the same way.
I mean, you were looking
at things you never had a chance to look at before.
Right. Wouldn't it have been cool if from the time that they had signed that treaty until you got on those buses, if you could have went around Hanoi?
Yeah.
Could have went around Hanoi to go to the museum, go to the opera house,
well,
go to the lake.
We did do some of that during the war. We did go out on
trips. Oh, you did?
Trips.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
We went out about 4 or 5 times.
Okay, so you did get a go.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So when you got to the Philippines, how were you treated? Did they separate the peace committee from everybody else?
Yeah, we were on one wing of a hospital floor.
Mm-hmm.
We noticed that we were all put in, there were two of us to a room. I was in the room with Al Riotti,
mm-hmm.
But we were all, there were 8 of us. We were all together. I mean, we were all in the same wing, and then we were kind of separated from, but people moved around, you know.
Yeah.
One of the guys that I had that was assigned to me, he was I think staff sergeant or sergeant first class or something that was, and he said, I asked him, I said, how come we're down here away from where everybody else is? And he said, oh, well, you know, they just didn't know how you guys were going to act. I said, well, I can almost guarantee you we didn't know how we were going to act.
Yeah,
either.
I can imagine.
He said, but, you know, it we interacted with everybody.
Yeah.
Something was happening, then
yeah.
You know, somebody would come running down and uh-huh. tell us, and we'd all go do this or whatever. Yeah. So
I heard you got a lot of support from the people in the hospital.
Yeah.
I heard you I heard the peace committee got a lot of help. I mean, they looked at you guys as you did the right thing.
Well, I got that feeling from some people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a dentist that I saw that he seemed very supportive mm-hmm. of. You know, nobody was too talkative, but at the same time, it became clear to us that people knew.
Oh, they knew. There's no doubt. They knew. Yeah, I heard what I've read and heard is that there was a lot of support for you guys.
Yeah.
A lot of support, which is because they were doing the same thing, Bob.
Yeah.
They were
yeah.
protesting the war, just like you guys were.
Yeah.
I mean, you did the right thing. You guys did the right thing, man. I was so proud of you guys. I was so proud of you guys, man. So the guys that we know, Riadi has passed away. Riadi died in the Philippines.
Yes, that's correct.
And King Rayford, he's still alive.
Yes, as far as I know, he is.
Daly died of diabetes.
Yes.
He died of diabetes. Young is still alive.
Yeah, I don't know where he is, though.
Chenoweth, you're still alive.
Yeah.
Kavanaugh died.
Yes, he committed suicide in July.
Yeah,
late June.
Yeah, he just got home.
73.
And he committed suicide. He committed suicide. Michael Branch is alive.
Yeah.
And Elbert's alive.
Yes.
Have you ever... I know we've talked about this before, and I almost got a hold of King Rayford.
Well, we stayed in touch with each other for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got together a few times. And then we all got together at John Young's once, and we got together in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I kept pretty close touch with Jim Daly.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed friends for
yeah.
a long time. And,
yeah.
and, you know, and his wife called me and told me when he passed away. Mm-hmm. So, but I think people just...
Went on with their lives.
Yeah, they just went on with their yeah. lives, and we needed to have a little... Mm-hmm. space and
yeah.
and I you know I never I don't think anyone had any animosity or anything.
I don't just, did you guys go to Kavanaugh's funeral?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that had to be hard. That
yeah.
had to be hard. How about
yeah.
Bob, I want to ask you about two other guys, these two officers, Walter Wilbur and Edison Miller.
Right.
Wilbur was a commander. Navy commander yeah. pilot.
Navy commander.
And Edison Miller, he was a lieutenant colonel, and they were both anti-war.
Yes, they were. We met them at a music performance in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
We got to sit with them in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in Vietnam People's Army Song and Dance Ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a performance for us in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, the Vietnamese seated them with us.
With you guys.
Yeah.
yeah.
So we had a chance to visit with those guys.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I got together one time, I think, with Ed Miller.
Yeah, he moved down to Southern California.
Right, he was in Southern California.
You know that he was, like, on the city commission for Orange County?
Yeah, he went to law school.
Yes, he did. Yeah,
yeah,
he did. And also, you when you were back, you met with George Smith.
Yes,
with
yeah,
George, he was in the anti-war movement, just like you were.
Yeah, well, George toured with the Indochina Peace Campaign
with you,
and then no, he was on the tour before.
Mm-hmm.
They had done it. Either a year or 2 years before, they'd done the same thing. And then
mm-hmm.
I went with it. And we stopped in, we were in Pittsburgh. And George lived in West Virginia. And
right.
he came over And then when I lived in Ohio, I went to visit him a couple of times, too.
Yeah, because he really turned against the war.
He worked for the post office.
He worked for the post office, right. Yeah, he really turned against the war.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole country did, Bob.
Yeah.
The things that you guys were saying in the prisons in the North were what we were saying over here.
Yeah.
I mean, you were saying it, the same things that we were saying.
Yeah.
Same things. You know what, to me, is that you were been out of, got out of the Army, let's see, what year would you have got a regular discharge if you hadn't been captured?
I would have gotten out in 69, in June of 69.
So for 4 years, past your time, and the Army thought they still owned you?
Yeah.
I'd have told them to.
Yeah, well, you know.
Bob, I want to thank you for doing this. And
oh, you're welcome.
We got a lot of great feedback from the last show we did. And you got a lot of friends in the KBOO community, buddy. A lot of friends who believe in what you did, and you did right.
You guys have a good program there. It's whenever I drive down to Portland, I always switch over to KBOO.
Good deal.
I switch from public radio over to KBOO.
Good for you.
It's not that big of a jump.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I want to thank you again. Bye, Bob.
All right. Bye-bye.